I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. If Facebook were a country, it would be the third largest in the world after China and India. That's what Rebecca McKinnon writes in her new book, Consent of the Networked, in a chapter titled Facebookistan and Googledom. She writes about the power of the internet to mobilize protests that she observed up close in China when she was Beijing bureau chief for CNN. She also describes how authoritarian governments have used social media to censor and harass their citizens, and she raises concerns about civil liberties in this country and the relationship between our own government and companies like Google, Apple, Amazon, and Facebook. Rebecca McKinnon is a co-founder of Global Voices Online. That's a citizen media network, and she's a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. In fact, joins us from their studios. And Rebecca McKinnon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Let me take us all back to China in the 1990s. You were bureau chief there and observed what the internet could do. This is obviously pre-Arab Spring. How did the government fight back against its own citizens using the internet?
Well, you know, it's always been a real kind of arms race or cat and mouse game. You know, the internet showed up in China in the mid-90s, and you immediately saw people using it to access information from around the world that they couldn't easily get before, and to exchange information about what was happening. But the government immediately started blocking websites that they didn't want people to see, and requiring companies that operate in China that provide internet services to do censorship and surveillance work on behalf of the government. So they started requiring this, and they sort of anticipated that, China, like all countries, needs the internet in order to be part of the global economy. But at the same time, they wanted to manage it to make sure that nobody could use it to, you know, overthrow the government. And so far, they've managed to keep the balance. You know, the people do use the internet to bring up a lot of issues, but they're not able to use it to form an opposition party and really bring people out into the streets, because people get arrested before that point.
And taking us to the Arab Spring, Ghanim said that if you want to liberate a society, give us the internet. And of course, this was a rallying cry in Egypt, which part of the uprising in the Middle East. Was he right about that?
Well, he was half right. I mean, I think definitely if you don't have the internet, if you don't have modern communication tools, it's going to be pretty hard to organize and do anything. But it's not all you need. You know, one of the big problems in Egypt is that, yes, they brought down a dictator, but there's a real challenge in terms of, will they be able to build a stable and successful democracy? And the internet is whether, you know, what role the internet's going to play in that regard, and, you know, to what extent it's just about good old-fashioned politicking is much less clear. And also, the current government in Egypt is still surveilling the internet. They're not censoring it, but they're monitoring what people are doing on the internet, and activists realize that, and so they do have to be careful.
Careful, obviously, in what they're saying, for fear that they could be arrested or be harassed or pay some kind of price for their activism online?
That's right. That, you know, actually, after Mubarak fell, there was a period of chaos for a couple months where people actually were able to get into the state security headquarters, and some activists found their own files, And it was full of reams and reams of their email transcripts, their cell phone text messages, and it was clear that evidence was being built against people that was going to be used against them, and that also authorities were using it to anticipate where people were going to be. And, you know, even though the government's changed, that technical capability is still in place. And a lot of the technology being used there is being used all over the world. And in fact, there's a company called Naris that sells its technology to all around the Middle East, which is owned by Boeing, based in California, and which also supplies basically the same technology, to various government agencies here.
Is there any way to know, then, who's winning the war online or the conflict online?
Well, you know, you have to, it depends on who and it depends on exactly where. I don't think you can sort of make a blanket statement about the whole world. It depends on, you know, to what extent a particular government is clever about how they're manipulating conversations, how they're monitoring things. It depends on a lot of offline circumstances, too. Like, so you look at Syria, for instance, you know, where people are getting massacred. The government is also very aggressive about monitoring the internet there. And so I would say, you know, the Assad government is winning in Syria at the moment, offline as well as on. In other countries, you know, let's say Russia, for instance, definitely it's a much more mixed picture. So it really depends.
Well, as I was reading your book, I was thinking about that phrase about the pen being mightier than the sword. And maybe there's a question mark at the end of that. But thinking about the internet as a kind of pen. Does that make sense?
Certainly, you know, and a lot of people talk about how, well, you know, you had pens and then you had movable type and the
right.
printing press,
right.
which is really, you know, people point to the printing press as a reason why democracy became possible because, you know, information could be disseminated and expressed so much more easily. And now you have the internet, which is sort of the next level of that in terms of making people interconnected and so on. So, you know, you definitely do need, I think, in today's world, if you want to bring about change, if you want to have democracy, you do need the internet. At the same time, you can't assume just because you have the internet that automatically democracy will result.
You describe and have a fascinating, provocative phrase, the sovereigns of cyberspace. And these are these large companies that operate around the world. Facebook, a very good example of that. Sovereigns of cyberspace in that they have amazing power, but they have not been elected like in democracies.
Yeah, well, you know, this is the thing, is that our digital lives, and all of us now in any kind of developed country, certainly here in the United States, we're really dependent on the internet and on our mobile phones for, you know, for our work, for our businesses, for our education, for our love lives in a lot of cases, mm-hmm. for organizing our family, and for our politics, right? And so we depend on, you know, our email and our smartphones and you know, our social networking services to communicate with people and so on. And so, you know, and all of these platforms and services are run by companies that, you know, their main reason for existence is to make a profit for their shareholders and for their investors. And so there's this whole issue of, you know, when they're making decisions about what you can and cannot do with your smartphone or how your information is being collected and who's being shared with or what you can and cannot do on Facebook and who knows what about you and what information is being collected and who it's being shared with and how the settings might change, you know, the decisions they're making, you know, to what extent does it matter to them how that's affecting not only our personal lives, but potentially our political lives and our ability to communicate and to know things or to engage in dissent, controversial speech without getting in trouble. And so there's this whole issue, and this is why I call them the sovereigns of cyberspace.
Right.
You know, they're not sort of like a government. They can't put you in jail or tax you, but at the same time, they're shaping what you can and cannot do with your reality, and they're shaping how you relate to the entire world and to your government. And so this whole question of, well, if that's the case, if they do have this much power over us, they need to be held accountable, mm-hmm. that they have a responsibility to the public interest. And I'm not saying that, you know, companies need to all turn, you know, that we should, you know, nationalize them or, you know, turn them into Human Rights Watch. But I'm saying, you know, just as we've gotten companies over decades, you know, companies didn't used to recognize that they had environmental responsibilities. Companies didn't used to recognize that they had responsibilities for the rights of their workers. And, you know, they're not perfect by any means, but they at least recognize now that this is part of their, you know, what we call social license to operate. And what we need to get companies to recognize now is that they also have a responsibility to us in terms of our freedoms, in terms of our freedom of expression, in terms of our privacy, to ensure that the internet evolves in a way that's compatible with democracy.
But do you think people are too willing to give up some of their civil rights and their privacy rights for the kind of access and convenience that the internet offers?
Well, I think, you know, this has always been an issue, and it's been an issue before the internet, too, that, that people, you know, generally they want convenience, they want security, they don't kind of think about their rights sometimes until it's, you know, a little too late. And certainly Facebook is, you know, it's wonderful in many ways in terms of how it connects people and enables people to do things and makes it more convenient to keep in touch with your high school friends or to run an environmental campaign or, you know, whatever. And, you know, our phones, et cetera, we're sort of giving up privacy and because of the convenience of being able to be connected all the time. But we do need to start thinking about, you know, this isn't just we just have to give up, that actually companies can make a lot of choices about the extent to which they're collecting information, what they're doing with it, how secure our communications are, the extent to which we can be tracked. You know, there's a lot of specific choices that can be made, and we need to push companies to make the right choices.
But are you also saying that, that in this country, that it's easier for our government to search our digital communication than it is to peer inside our houses or check our snail mail?
That's absolutely true. You know, in order for the authorities to go through your postal mail, you know, that requires a warrant. In order to go through your filing cabinets, or to go through your safe in your home or your office, that requires a warrant. They have to be able to show that there's cause. But when it comes to your electronic communications, it's much more vulnerable. And because the law is also out of date, you know, if your email is more than 90 days old and it's sitting, you know, on in your Gmail server or sitting really on a remote server anywhere, the authorities can access that without a warrant because, according to law, which is completely out of date, is considered abandoned, which is obviously not the case anymore.
Well, and we're almost up in a break here. Which law is that? Because you write about the Patriot Act, you write about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
So the law is called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and it was passed in the 1980s. Back, you know, before we even had the World Wide Web, there was, you know, the primitive version of the internet where people would send email back and forth from computer to computer, and it would only briefly go through some kind of central server before it would stay in your computer. So back in those days, you know, if the authorities needed a warrant to search your computer, but if your email was stored in some central service somewhere and you hadn't retrieved it for 90 days, it was considered abandoned, sort of like an abandoned mailbox. But, of course, that's not the case anymore because we're all storing all our stuff remotely.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Rebecca McKinnon, our guest today in Radio Times, talking about her interesting new book called Consent of the Networked, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom, a co-founder of Global Voices Online, a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
ChristianaCare Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
Bring your appetite, food fanatics, as WHYY celebrates some of the region's greatest culinary minds with Best of the Chefs, a two-hour tasting featuring an array of area restaurants, breweries, and businesses. They'll serve up their tastiest treats, and your votes decide who is crowned Best of the Chefs in several mouth-watering categories. Also, a raffle, beer garden, and live music, Thursday, June 21st. Tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
From the shores of the Dead Sea comes one of the most significant archaeological finds of the 20th century, the Dead Sea Scrolls at the Franklin Institute. featuring more than 600 Holy Land artifacts and a rare glimpse of the authentic Dead Sea Scrolls. Also, a look at millennia-old traditions that continue to impact Western society today. The Dead Sea Scrolls, now open at the Franklin Institute. For tickets, 215-448-1200 or online at fi.edu. The Franklin Institute supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking about how we preserve and promote civil liberties and democratic values online. Rebecca McKinnon, our guest, author of this new book called Consent of the Networked, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. She was bureau chief for, Beijing bureau chief for CNN. She's co-founder of Global Voices Online, a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. And we have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments, give us a call, 1-888-477-WHYY. Rebecca, I had mentioned the Patriot Act, and if I can just roll back the clock about a little bit more than, or a little less than a decade ago, how has that affected digital, private digital communication?
Well, definitely, the Patriot Act allows the FBI to and other agencies to obtain telecommunications, financial, and credit records without a court order. Of course, it was passed at a time when there was definitely a feeling that the nation was under attack and it was urgent. But there's been an effort since then to revise the Patriot Act to basically bring government agencies access to our electronic communications under greater supervision and accountability, and to deal with some of the more egregious provisions. But there's been opposition really on both sides of the aisle to that reform, also to another act of legislation called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Amendments Act, which gives U.S. companies immunity from being sued by their customers when they comply with blatantly illegal government surveillance requests directed at those customers. And so because of that act, it sort of retroactively gave immunity to companies like AT&T, which allowed the NSA to build rooms, and we found out about this through whistleblowers, in their facilities around the country to basically capture all the communications going through these exchange points. All of these customers, most of them were not suspected of any crime, yet AT&T, the NSA, with the help of AT&T, was basically conducting what we call dragnet surveillance, taking all of these communications and then sifting through them for communications of interest. This is civil liberties groups have been fighting this, saying that this is blatantly unconstitutional. So far, they haven't gotten very far in fighting it.
You also write about how this government, our own government, handled the WikiLeaks issue. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so, the WikiLeaks case is of course, very complicated, and it started because allegedly a U.S. service member named Bradley Manning, who was stationed in Kuwait, got a hold of, had access to classified documents from the state, mainly from the State Department, which he then leaked to WikiLeaks, and he is currently, of course, being prosecuted for that. But WikiLeaks, the site itself, published these documents in late 2010, and quite a number of American politicians then made statements about how WikiLeaks was illegal, and Julian Assange, the head of WikiLeaks, should be prosecuted, and so on. And the State Department wrote a memo about how WikiLeaks was committing a crime, But then, you know, no case was ever brought against WikiLeaks, the website, because, you know, we have this thing called the First Amendment, mm-hmm. and nobody's been able to prove that they actually committed a crime other than speech, other than publishing documents, which had been leaked. But that's kind of similar to the Pentagon Papers in a way with newspapers in the past. So no charges had actually been filed against WikiLeaks. No court case there's been no court proceedings against WikiLeaks in the United States. But WikiLeaks, at the time they published these documents, was using a web hosting service because, you know, if you're running a website, the data actually has to be hosted on computers somewhere. Mm-hmm. And they were renting space from Amazon. Amazon has a web hosting service in addition to selling books and all that other stuff that it does. And Amazon, you know, has terms of service. So when you sign up for an account to host a website on Amazon's web hosting service, of course, there's these terms of service about, you know, we can, you know, if you do this and that, we can terminate our service, and here are the terms. And the terms were, as often is, you know, we can terminate your account if we decide that you violated the terms, mm-hmm. and for any reason, et cetera. And so Amazon basically, you know, after all of this furor, uproar began to come out about WikiLeaks, they dropped WikiLeaks as a customer, terminated their business with WikiLeaks, and so it went offline briefly before it went and found a service somewhere else in Europe. But the point being is that you have speech which, you know, is constitutionally protected, arguably. I mean, it's obviously very controversial speech, but you can make a pretty strong First Amendment case that it has a right to exist. But you have a business that the speech is depending on for us to see it, and they don't have to respect the First Amendment. They can drop this speech for any reason they want, it's private terms of service.
But
the point being is that they responded to political pressure.
Well, I was going to say, were they doing the government's bidding from your perspective? And that would be our own government, obviously.
Well, they were clearly responding to political pressure. You know, I think it's often more complicated than saying that, you know, mm-hmm. the government calls up companies and right. then companies just do their bidding. But companies don't like to be caught in the middle of political controversies. And I think they were worried that they'd lose other business from people who don't like WikiLeaks. And they decided it was just too hot for them to host. And this is an issue you see actually with a number of companies. You know, Apple has an app store where basically it's their staff who decides, you know, what apps can be in their store and what apps cannot. And, you know, there are cases where they've just, you know, that they would basically reject apps for political cartoonists and people who were definitely engaged in speech that's constitutionally protected in this country, but reject these apps because they're too, you know, offensive to one group or another. So companies are definitely making their own decisions about what speech can stand and what speech cannot, that is much more narrow and much more arbitrary than the First Amendment protections. And so my point is that, you know, in this world where people are increasingly dependent on these companies for our public discourse, and these companies are making somewhat arbitrary decisions or making decisions for business reasons rather than public interest reasons, we need to be very careful about where this is headed.
Well, what would be the difference between Apple deciding that they're not going to carry certain apps and, let's say, a bricks and mortar bookstore that decided it wasn't going to carry a particular book? Is there any difference there?
Well, I think the difference is of scale and the extent to which that bookstore is your only source of books or not. and how much choice you have. And, you know, if you have a bookstore that's like, okay, we're only going to sell certain types of books, mm-hmm. But there are plenty of other ways to get books that, you know, very easily, then it may not matter so much. If you're locked into using an iPhone and you can't kind of buy a new phone very easily, and you've got a large percentage of people using iPhones, you know, and they've got their plans and so on, they can't just kind of day-to-day switch to an Android or some other kind of phone, you know, that's affecting a significant percentage of people's, you know, and a lot of people are kind of using, depending on their iPhones, for a whole range of information, and that sort of becomes their information universe. And so it's one of these kind of subtle and insidious things that kind of chips away at how people, you know, interact with their world, what speech is reaching what audiences, to what degree. And cumulatively, I think it has a real effect.
And that's Rebecca McKinnon, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about her new book called Consent of the Networked, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. And she joins us from the studios of the New America Foundation, where she's a senior fellow, also co-founder of Global Voices Online. Since you use the Internet, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm actually looking at a headline from the New York Times, and just, I guess, looks like last week on June 8th, Facebook holds a vote and turnout is low. And I'm just quoting here, Facebook held elections offering users a chance to vote on the way that the site is governed. The response was less than 1%. What does that tell you, Rebecca?
Well, that vote was pretty interesting. I've been checking in with a lot of communities who are heavy Facebook users and who are also fairly active on political issues, and a lot of people were not aware that the vote had taken place.
Well,
and Facebook claims they promoted it and that they were disappointed with the turnout, but it really seems that it was not very heavily promoted. I mean, I'd be really interested to hear from your listeners, you know, those who use Facebook several times a week, you know, how many of them knew that this vote was taking place. It didn't seem like it was promoted that heavily. And, you know, but it is interesting. I mean, the reason why they held the vote was that they were pushed to do so by a group of European activists. So there's this European law student in Austria named Max Schrems, who has kind of started up this organization called Europe Versus Facebook, that's trying to get Facebook to change its privacy policies and be more transparent about what data it collects on people, and to collect less data on people. And he basically got his followers and his audience to post so many comments on their governance page, kind of complaining about the changes that Facebook was planning to make on its privacy policy, that based on Facebook's own rules, they were forced to hold a vote. But, you know, I would say that they could have done a lot more to promote this thing than they've let on. And so Max Schrems, this guy in Vienna who forced the vote, has been comparing this election to kind of Chinese elections for the National People's Congress, you know, this sort of a sham democracy.
But do you think companies like Facebook are responsive to user protests? And we hear about, you know, the importance of a customer service in the world of consumerism. Do you think that also works online?
Well, I think these companies do realize that if people completely do not trust them, they're going to lose business, and that they need to respond. And you've seen a lot of cases over the past few years of users reacting very badly to certain changes that Facebook made, and then Facebook kind of readjusting. So they do care at some level, but they also are trying to figure out how to monetize the service. There's also a lot of things they're not listening to. There are a lot of users who are really concerned about the fact that they can't use, you know, what we call pseudonyms, mm-hmm. Pet aliases online. And some people, you know, not just dissidents in Syria or China who might get, you know, jailed for their activism online, but also people in the United States. Let's say that you're a proponent of gay marriage, but your boss is really against it, and, you know, a lot of political activism in this country is now happening through mm-hmm. Facebook, but you can't engage in it if you have to do it using your real name on Facebook. And you know, given how much political activity is now happening on Facebook, that kind of, you know, that has an impact. And so people who are victims of spousal abuse mm-hmm. have had real concerns about the inability to use aliases or pseudonyms on Facebook, and feel that, you know, here it's being touted, and Facebook's actually promoting itself as a place where, you know, members of Congress should use it to interact with their constituents, and, you know, the Obama campaign is relying on Facebook very heavily as part of its campaign strategy. And in those kinds of situations, you know, when Facebook is not kind of making absolutely every effort to protect people's privacy and enable people to engage in politics, even when it's risky for them to do so, you know, that's a problem.
Right. Not to get off on a tangent here, but I do know people who use their dog's name on Facebook, and they haven't gotten in trouble yet.
Yeah, well, what happens, you know, it's really interesting. if you're on Facebook using your dog's name and you're not all that active, you're probably never going to have a problem. But if you're an activist using a fake name and you have enemies and your account is kind of, you're posting a lot of stuff and people are responding and kind of arguing with you, and if you have enemies, people will generally, if they think you're using a fake name, they will report you for terms of service violation. And then somebody on Facebook staff will check the account and say, this does indeed look like a fake name. And so then they'll deactivate the account or request that the user provide evidence of their legal name and so on. So I've heard from quite a lot of activists who've had their account deactivated for that reason.
And you talk about Facebookistan. Is the problem with Facebook that if you don't want to be there, or you're concerned about your own safety there, where do you go?
Yeah, well, that's the concern. I mean, if you're trying to, you know, again, you don't have to be on Facebook. And I know plenty of people who are not there and who don't need to be there. But if you're an environmentalist, let's say, trying to raise awareness about what's happening in your city on a particular issue, and if you're not using every tool available to reach people, you're less effective. And so, you know, you have to be on Facebook because that's where a lot of people are, and that's where you can get things to go viral and really bring it to people's attention. And so you need to be there, even if you don't really like the way the site is governed. And I hear this from a lot of activists in a lot of countries who say, it's risky for me to be on Facebook, but if I'm not there, then I'm not going to have an impact and I'm not going to be successful. So I have to be there.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation, also get some callers in on the conversation. Do you worry about your privacy online or even your civil rights online? That's what our guest Rebecca McKinnon writes about in her new book called Consent of the Networked, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. A couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And our guest, Rebecca McKinnon, was the CNN bureau chief in Beijing, co-founder of Global Voices Online, that's a citizen media network, and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Focus Features, presenting the new film Moonrise Kingdom, directed by Wes Anderson and starring Bruce Willis, Edward Norton, Bill Murray, Frances McDormand, and Tilda Swinton. Moonrise Kingdom, in select theaters now.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. At Fox Chase, molecular medicine helps improve diagnostics for cancer patients. Using the genetic analysis of tumor cells, doctors readily identify the best use of existing cancer drugs and design more effective clinical trials. As DNA sequencing becomes more prevalent in cancer care, Fox Chase is committed to discovering how these methods can best help patients and lead to better outcomes. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. This week, Jamie Dimon heads to Congress. Will he be publicly castigated for those huge losses at J.P. Morgan? Also this week, Nick Belenda will try to walk a wire across Niagara Falls. We'll remember Annie Edson Taylor, the first person to go over the falls in a barrel. What's the fascination with the falls? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Bosch Thermotechnology, manufacturer of geothermal heat pumps that use the constant temperature of the earth to heat and cool homes. More information at boschgeo.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The struggle for internet control continues to grow as we rely more on digitally networked platforms and devices and services. Our guest, journalist Rebecca McKinnon, looks at the high stakes of civil liberties and privacy issues that consumers are dealing with in her new book, Consent of the Network, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's get, looks like Ken from Newark, Delaware to join us. And Ken, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. Incredible interview. I'm really impressed, and there's so many topics that can probably fill up more than a week of shows here.
Indeed.
But I wanted to take a look at the what I'm seeing lately. It's a little bit frustrating, the idea of true internet searches, or what Facebook is doing, where, you know, if you don't click on someone's status or whatever, they assume that you're not really interested in that person, so they end up just hiding it. For Google, you know, if I go and do a search based on my history, it's going to bring up one thing. If you do it, it's going to bring up another. I would argue there ought to be an option to be able to say, you know what, I just want a pure, simple search. Just give me what I'm asking for, not based on any previous searches.
Well, Ken, you're not alone in that. Rebecca McKinnon, go ahead.
Yeah, well, this is an issue, and this is why I think it's so important that we never be dependent on just one service, and also that we continue to challenge what these companies are doing, and why it's so important for journalists to really be and users to be kind of pointing out when our information gets manipulated and bringing it to people's attention, and hopefully that users will, you know, kind of punish these companies for not respecting our rights and interests. It's interesting, you know, you should definitely try logging out of Google and do a search and then log in, you know, or use a different browser and then compare, like, the search results when you're logged in and when you're logged out, and see just kind of what the difference is. And you're absolutely right with Facebook. You know, this is an issue, is that we assume that we're going to see, you know, everybody who's in our friends network when they post something, that it'll show up in our news feed. But actually, it turns out that only the ones that you frequently interact with are going to show up in your news feed, and that, again, you know, shapes how people are communicating. This is exactly why sort of having over-dependence and sort of quasi-monopoly power by any one service is very dangerous, and why, you know, you should conduct alternative searches on other search engines and not just assume that Google is the end-all and be-all for information out there. Again, we need to continuously question, just like, you know, I think we've come to assume that any given newscast that we watch or newspaper that we read is not necessarily the gospel truth, right? It's shaped by all kinds of different factors, you know, depending on who owns it and who the journalists are and all kinds of different things. You know, similarly, that's going to be the case with our with these internet services, and we need choice, we need diversity, and we need transparency, and we need to really push these companies to be very clear with us about how our information is not only gathered but presented, and you know what we see on searches, what we see on our news feeds and Facebook, what's getting deleted, what's getting hidden from us, what's getting favored. We need to know that. We need to understand that so that we know what we're missing, and we can then choose more objectively whether this service is right for us.
Quoting from your book here, you say it's time to stop debating whether the internet is an effective tool for political expression and to move on to the much urgent question of how digital technology can be structured, governed, and used to maximize the good it can do in the world, underscoring what you just said there. But in terms of, as you say, punishing these companies, is it going somewhere else? Is it obviously, you can organize online. We've seen lots of evidence of that, using the network to push back against some of these companies.
Yeah, well, I think users of these services could be doing a lot more to push back, could be organizing a lot more. I think we've gotten we know how to organize politically when we don't like what a government has done, when we don't like what our congresspeople are doing. We sort of know what the levers are that we can exercise to push back. But I think with these internet companies, we need to get more organized at figuring out, how do we demand that they pay attention? And part of it, particularly with companies that you've come to depend on and you don't have really good alternatives, just saying, oh, we're going to leave. Some people tried to organize a Facebook boycott a couple years ago and it totally failed. But you are seeing, some groups that just get a lot of users together and make a lot of noise on the site are starting to have an impact. So, how can we do that in a more organized way? I think we need to look at that. But to get to your larger point, you were citing something I said earlier in the book about, I think it's a given that, yes, the internet is empowering. But what the internet is today, what you can and cannot do on the internet, the extent to which you can be anonymous or not, what you can access, what you cannot access, that is not like a force of nature. That's not the result. It's not like the air you breathe or the water you drink. It's the result of decisions being made by humans, by engineers, by programmers who work for companies, by legislators who are passing laws that shape what these companies can and cannot do, and by a whole lot of users. And so the point being is that if we want the internet to evolve in a way that complements the kind of society that we want to have, we need to work for that. We need to fight for that just in the same way if you want your city to be governed in a way that respects your rights and interests. If you are completely not involved with how the city is governed and you never vote and you never pay attention, you're sort of going to get what the government you deserve because you didn't get involved. And similarly, we're going to get the internet we deserve, and we need to be involved in it, as which is why I use this term netizens. Just as we're citizens of a society, of a country, of the cities and communities we're in, we're not subjects. We got over being subjects of kings quite some while back. We need to stop being just passive users of technology and become sort of netizens of the internet.
But I didn't vote for Mark Zuckerberg.
No, you didn't. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. Ken, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Let me get to Robert from Hamilton, New Jersey to join us. Robert, go ahead. You're on the air. Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. She's talking about choices a few minutes ago. I chose to go with Apple and buy an iPhone because of their very well-publicized policy of vetting their apps in the App Store. Mm-hmm. I can download an app and know that it's virus-free, and it will work. I have well over, almost 200 apps on my phone. They all work.
So, go ahead, Rebecca.
Yeah, well, that's a really good point. And I think that's an important point you make, because absolutely, Apple does vet the security of their apps. And that is absolutely one of the selling points. And I think this kind of gets to the heart of the issue of, you know, sort of democracy, really, you know, because there's always this tension between our need for security and our need for freedom and choice, right? And there's always a trade-off. And this is one reason why we have government in our physical space, is because we're giving up, you know, complete freedom so that we'll have some security and protection from bad guys who might want to attack us, and, you know, to have a police force that keeps people from robbing us, and et cetera. And so, in a way, you know, it's the same kind of bargain with Apple, in that, you know, you're choosing their service, and they're saying, you know, we're gonna do the vetting for you of, you know, to make sure that you don't have apps downloaded on your iPhone that are then gonna, you know, be run by criminals and steal your credit card information and so on. And that is a serious security problem. But the issue is that they are also making kind of arbitrary political and cultural choices in their vetting of apps. So, for instance, here's an example. Late last year, a woman who made a documentary about prostitution in Rhode Island contracted a reputable company that frequently makes apps for independent filmmakers, and which has always had its apps approved by Apple in the past. She contracted with them to make an app for her film that was basically about, you know, just really meant to be a public education vehicle for teaching people about trafficking of women and kind of issues of prostitution in the United States and so on. It was, you know, kind of it is kind of classic types of, you know, public interest but controversial material, yet educational, definitely not porn, that you see in the media in this country, and which is very much protected speech. But her app was rejected, and she never got any clear explanation, except that she was told that, you know, it violated their terms. And she points out that her app, you know, while her app dealing with prostitution was rejected, you know, there's an HBO app which makes available a whole show about prostitution. So, you know, there's some kind of, you know, in the way they're governing their decisions about what apps are permitted and what are not, there's certainly some important security functions they're playing that are very important for all of us. But at the same time, they're also making these other decisions. There's political cartoonists who've had their apps rejected because they were told they were too controversial. And so Apple needs to be more open and transparent about how they're making these decisions, because it is hurting particularly kind of freelancers and independent artists and people who are creating political speech that are not working for large companies.
And there was even, I do want to get back to our callers, even some controversy about an app, a Ulysses app as well.
That's right. That's right, because there was a little bit of nudity in there.
Let me get, looks like Ron from Chestnut Hill, I guess. Go ahead, Ron, you're on Radio Times.
Hi there. I was just saying about your comment about Facebook. Facebook is a free service, so when anything is free, there's only so much that we can demand and so much we can expect Facebook to respond to those demands.
Well, that's an interesting comment. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Rebecca?
Well, you know, there's something to be said for that, but then they are also making money off of us and our identities. And so there are a lot of people who would also argue that we're being exploited to a certain degree. And yes, it is free, and perhaps we are giving up too much, which is why I argue if, you know, we need to, I think we can push, because on the other hand, if we if people are not going to trust Facebook, if people are going to use it less or use it in a more reserved way, or start sharing more things on other services because they trust those services more, then Facebook over time is going to lose value. So I think there's a certain long-term value proposition that goes with the need for Facebook to figure out how that they can make sure that they have a trusting relationship with their users over the long run. And if people feel that their rights are not being respected, that's not a trusted relationship. And I would argue over the long run, it probably will be bad for their business.
Oh, let me squeeze one more caller in. Ron, thanks for the call. Carla from Newark, Delaware, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Continuing on Facebook, one of the things, what alternatives do we have when companies on the internet say, if you want more information, click. You click on the icon or for information and it leads you right to Facebook. If you're not a Facebook member, how do you get information from the companies? And what alternatives do we have? It seems to get all kinds of information from companies now that you're required to become a Facebook member.
Well,
and I'll take my answer off the
air. Thanks, Carla. Rebecca, we have about a minute before I have to say goodbye.
Yeah,
go ahead.
That's really bad, and it's particularly bad when news companies do this, but it's a socially irresponsible practice. And I think I think that customers and investors should be really pushing companies. Not, you know, okay, you can have a Facebook page, but then you also need to have a publicly available web page that people can access without having a Facebook account. Mm-hmm.
But do you think, and I hear the not just the passion in your voice, but also I hear your argument, and do you think that the time is right for some kind of online activism on some of these issues that we've been talking about?
Yeah, well, I think we're seeing a movement growing. You know, definitely in the past year, you know, there's been a movement growing against certain legislation that's both cybersecurity legislation and copyright legislation that would have limited freedom on the internet, and you're also seeing more activism directed at companies. So I think we're sort of kind of like, you know, we're sort of like 1970 and Earth Day when the environmental movements just got going. This is kind of, you know, we're at that stage now with the internet freedom movement.
Well, Rebecca McKinnon, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
And she's sorry about that little pause there. And she's the author of a new book called Consent of the Networked, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. She's a co-founder of Global Voices Online. That's a citizen media network. Also a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. In fact, joined us from the studios of the New America Foundation. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.